What's up, y'all?
My future isn't determined by where I currently reside. Understanding your worth will put pride in your stride. I'm accountable to my call. There's no compromise. I set my own bar, and you better know it's set high.
It's giving what it's supposed to give. Ooh, stop playing with them.
What's up, y'all? It's your girl, Deshari. Welcome back to another episode of It's a Perspective, a show dedicated to uncovering different perspectives through dope conversation. Today, we have a special guest. He is an unconventional by purpose thought provoker, all-time great debater, cultural, gender, and educational advocate. He's what some call woke, but could be better recognized as conscious if that doesn't give it away. He's the man with the plan, a social media sensation, educator, influencer, orator, and so much more. A nominee for the 2022 NAACP Image Awards, recipient of YouTube's Content Creator Award. He's a part of YouTube Black Voices Fund and has been recognized by Forbes, Essence, Washington Post, BET, and so much more. He's also delving into his executive producing and acting bag with his documentary, Conscious Controversies, Art on the Chopping Block. I would be remiss not to also add, hosting, teaching, educated with a Master's of Arts in Adult Higher Education and Human Resources. Most importantly, though, he's a husband and a father. Y'all, welcome Mr. Conscious Lee. What's up, bro? Yeah. How's it going?
Going good.
That is what's up.
Just woke up. I had a whole bunch of family over for 4th of July. And the last of the family just left.
Wow. Okay. Listen, y'all was turning up, wasn't y'all?
Yeah. A lot of staying up until the wee hours in the morning, yapping, talking, waking up early, going to sleep late, you know.
Yeah, I totally understand. Well, I'm glad you got to have some time with your family because, like, I know you are a busy dude, so you get to spend some quality time, you know, when you can. So that's a good thing. But I'm so excited to have you on the show today. I feel like this conversation has been long awaited, but very much so needed. I'm excited to inquire your perspective on so many things. I feel like I don't even know where to start. But because this is Issa's perspective, we're going to start with That's My Jam. This is a segment of the show where you can play a mantra or your favorite song. What you got for us?
Big Crit, as small as a giant.
All right. Well, let's get into it. As small as a giant, we still ride. Hand on the sword, good Lord, I need time. Watch for the sun, either blocking our shine. And like my kind, reason for rhyme. I'm a fine sign, free my soul. I feel like that's very consciously of you to have chose that song for your jam.
Yeah. That's one of the first Big Crit projects that I feel like captured my attention and was very thought-provoking when I was in college. And I was a policy debater in college, and I actually whooped a lot of intellectual ass in the debate room with that song specifically. And that first verse, the second verse, was actually a part of my affirmative constructive and a lot of my debate competition. That debated from 2012 to 2014, was very familiar with a lot of Big Crit, and familiar with me and my debate partner that debated at the University of Oklahoma. And that song was, I feel like, a perfect illustration of country, intellectual, emotional intelligence. Sonically it sounds good. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying?
Well, y'all, if y'all have not heard of that song like myself, this is my first time hearing about it. Big Crit, Small as a Giant. Go check that out today if you have not already. So we all know you as Consciously, right? The education is elevation, producer of great content and phenomenal thought pieces. But I want you to take us back to the beginning of Consciously.
The beginning when?
the very beginning. Well, we can go back to childhood, which is more Georgely than Consciously. Yeah, because I want to get into what you were just talking about with your debate at the University of Oklahoma. But I want to start more so at the beginning.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Bryan, Texas. About an hour and a half from Houston, Texas. Bryan College Station is probably what some of know it more as for me as the town that's right next to Texas A&M. Grew up on the west side of the town. First generation college student. Was really raised more by my grandmother. Well, actually, I was raised kind of stereotypically by the village. You know what I'm saying? Mm. I was with my mama, my daddy, my grandparents. With my mom or my dad was, you know what I'm saying, not there. I had some homeboys, moms that kind of, you know what I'm saying, was able to look after me here and there. Mm-hmm. So I was able to, I feel like, bounce around a lot. And a lot of times when I'm able to make my content, I feel like that's you getting snapshots of all of the various lives and experiences I've had in my past. You know what I'm saying? That's how I think about it when I make my content. It's like a cultivation of all my portable skills and experiences coming out at one time.
Okay. So what was I know you said that all of the culmination of your experiences growing up was kind of like how you started developing your content, but take us through some of that. Like what are some of the circumstances that you had to go to become conscious? You know, I feel like most of us, I know for myself, we're in some way sheltered from, you know, knowing all the parts of the bad parts of our Black community and things like that. But I know that's not the same for you. So how did you start to pick up these different pieces to kind of make yourself this woke conscious being, if you will?
I think my upbringing was very, very, I was exposed to a lot at mm-hmm. a very young age. And I think that it really impacted my psyche and how I understood, you know what I'm saying, life. My mother had me when she was 16 and my father was, you know what I'm saying, I think 2 years or a year older than her, so 17.
Mm. Okay.
Being raised by a young Black woman. My mother graduated high school with me, my sister, and she was pregnant with my other sister, you know what I'm saying? So my upbringing made it where I was exposed to a lot of, the streets a little bit. My mama had me when she was young, so she was dabbling in the streets here and there. My father was also dabbling in the streets here and there. I think it made it where I was able to see the side of what it means to live in life and luxury from like drug dealing, my mm-hmm. father. And then I was able to see kind of the ugly underbelly of drug addiction with my mom.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I was able to also, you know what I'm saying, my grandmother, you feel me, she mentioned, rest in peace, she died, I think, 2016,
17. Oh, I'm sorry
but,
to hear that.
She, you know what I'm saying, thank you. But she was addicted to drugs most of my life as well. So thinking about, like, really what I got to witness growing up in my little small country town in Texas, I think that it made it where I had a very resentful relationship with institutional power. And made it where I never really viewed the police in a good light. The first time I was introduced to the police is when they were breaking into my house to, you know what I'm saying, abduct my parents, or, wow. you know what I'm saying, attempting to abduct my parents, or the way in which we talked about the police when they came around mm-hmm. was always through the lens of policing, you know what I'm saying? And even when there wasn't any illegal substances around, there was still a very paranoid response to being around police and to policing. When you like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is very impressionable to how you know what I'm saying, relate to the laws or whatnot, you feel me?
Yeah.
But I think coming from a the west side of Bryan that is, you know, plagued with, you know, lower socioeconomic background, so it's like shit, high police presence, low employment rates, you know
right.
what I'm saying? And when you grow up around that, and you know, supply and demand make it where, you know, the types of industries my parents and my family and my uncles is exposed to is not the ones, you feel me, that my classmates necessarily in my pre-AP and AP classes I'm sitting in. I think mm-hmm. that also had an impact on me as well. I was one of the few token Black people that would be in those pre-AP honors AP classes in high school, and because I in middle school, and because I didn't I didn't grow up from a middle class background. You know what I'm saying? I don't come from an affluent background. You know what I'm saying? My mom and dad did not go to college. You feel me? So because I was one of the few black people in those spaces, and then probably the only black person that was really from like the hood like that, it made it where I grew up with a different perspective in the way in which people related to me and those other black people compared to the white people compared to this. I was very conscious of it at a young age. You know what I'm saying?
That's good.
But because I was able to be... I got lucky though too. I was able to. My father taught me how to promote and advertise. You feel okay. me? So I was a big party promoter in high school.
Wow.
I was throwing big parties like once a month. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Even though I was in a small town, I had people from other towns coming to my party. You feel me? So College Station, Hearn, Calvert, Navasota, Caldwell, Madisonville, all these little areas coming to my parties. You know what I'm saying? So when I was in high school, I was homecoming king, prom king, class president. But before I was very popular, I was picked on a lot when I was in maybe like middle school. Mm. So I think I've been able to experience a lot. You see what I'm saying? A lot of people that you know, I feel like the old Mike Jones songs back then, they didn't want me. Now I'm hot.
They all own me, right?
That was my damn back then. Because as a person, I used to grow up getting bullied, getting beat up on walking to school. You know what I'm saying? One summer, I went from being bullied and being made fun of and being the last pick to being the first pick. And now the girls think I'm cute. And now the dudes just want to hang around me. So it's like I was able to experience a lot. You know what I'm saying? I think that it makes me a very well-rounded person now.
Very
so
balanced.
I'm able to talk about my emotions and my feelings, or I don't never get caught up in the hoopla. You know what I'm saying? Even when I was in high school, being homecoming king or prom king of throwing parties, I never felt like I wanted to drink my own Kool-Aid or toot my own horn too much, because I'd never forget what it meant to be picked on, made fun of, this, that, and the other. And then you see me being like Oklahoma City, moving around, people would take pictures, this, that, and the other. I try to be cool, like, hey, thank you, this, that, and the other. But I'll never try to get too caught up in people liking me, because I know it'll switch to the foot, you know what I'm saying? Many people will not like you. But also, too, I know, like, you know what I'm saying? It's just... You know what I mean? But yeah, that long spiel. Sorry for that long.
No, you're good. You're good. It's a lot to unpack, but I kind of want to, you know, just go through it. So you grew up, you know, not in the most, I would say, conventional. You know, your parents, you know, had things going on because they were young themselves. But you also had the ability to have, you know, whether that was a little bit success in high school, becoming homecoming king, but also being able to experience something different by coming to Oklahoma and attending the University of Oklahoma, becoming a part of the debate team and receiving your master's and things like that. But I kind of want to see what doors have opened from you from a standpoint of like understanding versus vengeance, because I feel like in a way you could be a little vengeful of all the things that you've gone through or all the things that you see happening still, versus like the understanding like, okay, I know better. So I know that there's better out there, and you know, you are having better for yourself right now in your success, you know, with everything that you have going on. So what doors have opened for you?
Man, a lot of doors. Personally,
yeah.
I say. I feel like now my little energy drink. You know what I'm saying? My little seltzer water mixture is starting to hit in. So now I'm waking up a little bit more. I've had a lot of doors open for me, politically, socially, economically. The abundance of doors that continue to open for me really surprised me every day. I'm being real with you. You know what I'm saying? I just told you where I come from, and where I, you know what I'm saying, where I, like, my understanding of the world, how I was brought into the world.
Right.
So every time I'm recognized socially out in public, it blows my mind. Every time my manager or somebody hit me in my DM and I get a random business opportunity, I'm like, oh wow, you know who I do? You know who I am? Oh, for real? You know what I'm saying? So like the opportunities from being a part of NAACP Image Awards to having the opportunity to have a short film premiere at the Black Film Festival, and working with Issa Rae's company, to have an opportunity to get invited to Wayne Brady's partner's home, and you know what I'm saying, being around him and his family, to really, like, man, anytime I like a what. I've had conversations with George Lopez, you know what I'm saying, and a lot of people that I grew up watching. You feel me? They follow me on social media, you know what I'm saying? I think that from what you said, right, from how you started answering the question, how you started to ask the question, like, how do I respond from a way of kind of understanding and not resentment, and kind of how I heard that is like, I've been really focused on internally, externally, consciously, subconsciously thinking about healing, but like not from the new 2023 cliche social media, you feel me? I'm in my healing era nonsense. You see what I'm saying? Like really thinking about it from a real vulnerable state of emotional intelligence, and how I'm 32 years old right now. I'm talking to you as a 32 year old, but I've been being more mindful of the 16 year old George Lee, the 21 year old George Lee that still live in me, and I still respond by, even though I'm 32 years old, I can recognize, and there's moments when I respond like 23 year old me, like 25 year old me, like 15 year old me. You know what I'm saying? So I've been more thinking about the trauma, you feel me, around it.
Right.
I made a video. I posted a video today. I made the video a couple of days ago. I posted the video today. But what inspired the video was a tweet. The tweet said, trauma teaches you to survive by coping, defending, and avoiding being triggered.
Wow.
Healing teaches you to thrive by feeling, releasing, and owning your triggers. So what I learned, I feel like at a very young age, is that when you grow up in the hood, somebody will call you friendly. And being a straight, cisgender black man, somebody call you friendly, that really mean, you feel me? They feel like you exposable and disposable to be dominated.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? And that could be something that could be easily triggered. You know what I'm saying? A black man, a young black, you know what I'm saying? A young black man, a young black boy, you feel me? In a hood environment. At a young age, I think I figured out how to own the triggers and make it where an individual can't get me to operate and act based off of how they try to trigger my emotions. So when you say I'm friendly, I'm supposed to act in a very aggressively and not want to whoop your ass and show you I ain't friendly. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I am friendly. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I ain't the bit, but it don't mean you finna just pick with me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I don't think I have to prove to you that I need to, that I'm not to be fucked with in this instance to show to you that I'm not, you know what I'm saying, friendly. And I think that the young me responding that way, make it where on social media and when I was debating it, make it where I understand when reverse psychology is being used. And I understand when somebody's trying to use my triggers and my emotions and my insecurities against me. You know what I'm saying? And I think that at a young age, and now what I learned is how to make it where I'm going to respond from I'm going to try to have a healing response and not a traumatic response. And trying to necessarily, you know, there's times I can't control that, but I'm always trying to work on it and develop it. You see what I'm saying?
So,
I feel like in social media, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask was, I didn't mean to cut you off, but what?
I'm just blabbing now.
What do you feel like the difference is between like the healing era? Because you say you don't want to be in this, you know, today's age of what they call the healing era, and like actually taking the time out for yourself to maybe go to a therapy or counseling or something like that.
I think that healing is a constant process. So when you think about it through that cliche lens of a healing era, it makes it seem as if you're going to reach a starting point, you're going to reach an end point, you're going to reach the finish line of healing, and you can say, look, Shari, I'm healed.
Yeah.
I'm healed. It's me. I don't think about it that way, right?
Right.
I think about it like I'm always already bumping myself. I'm always already getting, you know what I'm saying, bruises. I'm always already being hurt and hurting myself.
Yeah.
So to me, healing is a constant state that I'm always being in.
Yeah. Or like you said, being re-triggered by something and have to heal all over again from it.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
So because I can recognize it from that standpoint, I think about it very deeply in terms of always knowing, like being real. There are things that I need to heal from that I'm not conscious of.
Wow. Okay. Let me stop you right there. Because speaking of triggers and things you need to heal from, I heard you got beef with us middle class folk. Unpack that for me.
I would say when I was in college, I developed a big resentment for black middle class people. But I can say that it's something I've healed from because it's something that I don't generalize. And I recognize that we all, like, the multiplicity of blackness and black people mean that we all come from it from different ways, right?
Oh wow.
And I recognize me being in the hood. And black middle class people being in wherever you know what I'm saying, the burbs or wherever you at, we experience institutions and power and domination a lot differently. And as a result, a lot of us have different strategies and different ways that we define domination and institutions and even racism. when I was in college, there was a lot of bootstrap mentality and a lot of eugenic like thinking that a lot of the middle class black people I went to school with had picked up on, mm-hmm. and had like was deploying against me. And then I was able to recognize the way in which a lot of whiteness, white supremacy, bootstrapping, hey George Lee, if you made it out the hood, then anybody can make it out the hood.
Right.
Well, my parents went to this, and I'm a first generation this, that, and the other, and it was like, I thought that it was, the word I would use now is, there was a lot of racial illiteracy.
Right, okay.
Amongst black middle class people, mm-hmm. that they were able to weaponize against lower class black people, and it was at our detriment, you know what I'm saying? Mm. Or how I saw it was the way in which we talk about, it's how I really learned it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm 19, 20 years old, and I'm already having like little beefs with, you know what I'm saying, other black people in, you know what I'm saying, in school, right?
Right, right.
When
right.
I learned about the civil rights movement and learned about how the civil rights movement mobilized one third of the black community, and there was 2/3 of the black community got left behind, I started thinking about the ways in which how in the black community, this the whole black community, not just poor blacks, not just middle class, black, not just black, but the whole black community, how we buy into the exposability of the 2/3 of black people that got left behind. You see what I'm saying? And what I was experiencing in that classroom when it came to other middle class black people, and in debate too, I recognize.
Mm-hmm.
In debate, there was, I feel like I feel comfortable now, and I feel like I, you know what I'm saying, can say it from a sense of understanding and not being like very vengeful, resentful, and being like, oh, this, that, and the other, not being on my Tupac shit.
Yeah.
I think what it was just a way that we all express and perform our blackness. And I think that there I was identifying a two-way resentment street, mm-hmm. of how middle-class black people always already is dealing with their blackness being questioned, or your way this, that, and the other, you know what I'm saying? And I felt like it was just a tension, you know what I'm saying? But I'm 32 years old now, and I'm middle-class, yeah. You know what I'm saying? I'm raising two middle-class black people, right? So yeah. I think about it very consciously about what was the difference between the black middle-class people I went to school with, and what they did, and how they thought about it, what I hated about what they did, and what was the ones I rocked with. And being real with you, one of the reasons why I'm no longer gonna live in Oklahoma is because I was starting to recognize, hey, my daughter's 7 years old, you feel me? My wife is biracial, so my daughter light-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to raise my daughter in 95% white norm in Oklahoma, and she only view black people through the lens of white people. A lot of middle-class black people I went to school with, they viewed, not all, and not even a lot, but my beef was a lot of the ways in which black people from the middle class view lower-class black people,
right,
through the lens of mainstream white America. And that shit used to blow me. Like,
yeah, it's really crazy, because I understand what you're speaking of. And I kind of want to talk about how to bridge that gap between, you know, knowing, because I feel like even in middle class, there are like people still in between, you know what I mean? So like there's like this like far right side, this far left side, and then there's like this in between, like for the black community in the middle class, you know what I mean? So it's like, how do we bridge the gap between, you know, you understanding, you know, you have your black power, you have, you know, things that you can do to make your situation better, but other people, you know, rallying with the not so good things that come with being, I'm trying to tread lightly here. With
don't tread lightly though. If I'm keeping the stack with you, I've now reached a place where I think, because there is a tiptoeing around acknowledging the socioeconomic tension amongst lower class black people and middle class black people, it makes it where we can't get vulnerable enough to really have a meaningful conversation. Because I can be real and say there is a deploying of anti-black violence coming from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are ways in which how black people from the hood are anti-black to middle-class black people. I think there are ways in which how middle-class black people are anti-black to black people from the hood.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have a real dialogue without being real about what's really going on, and being real about just going on and stepping over those triggers and or a risk being, you know what I'm saying, a bit problematic, because what we're dealing with is a problematic issue.
Yeah.
So when to me, you feel me, there is a lot of respectability politics and a lot of black pathology that operates. A lot of middle class black people view niggas as that, niggas.
Yeah.
You can't do this. You can't do that. Even think about it. If I'm being real with you, and I've said this, so I don't even feel bad about it. A lot of people in Oklahoma City view the Juneteenth on the East Side versus Washington State as this. What I'm talking about right now.
Yeah.
This is where the middle class black people go.
Yeah.
This is where the niggas from the hood go.
Yeah.
You feel me? And because I totally understand that type of distinction, you see what I'm saying, and make it where we can't have no real dialogue. So we have, you know what I'm saying. So I feel like, but that's not just Oklahoma City. That's the entire America. Gotta learn.
Yeah. It really is. But okay, so I feel like this could be a point where we could find a solution. Like, what is the solution between bridging the gap? Because I feel like it doesn't really necessarily have a lot to do with those in the upper class, right? Because I feel like they have their flaws. I feel like they have their issues. I feel like there's some things to work on up there, but they found their level of success, whatever that may be. But I feel like it's really between lower class, middle class, the black community. What is our solution to bridge the gap between the black conglomerate and better ourselves so that we can get, you know, assistance in moving forward? Like, I feel like the reason why we still experience some of the same things that we are experiencing in this world is because, like you said, we aren't having these conversations. So what is the solution?
Yeah, I think that Huey P. Newton says that power is the ability to define the phenomenon and make it act in a desired manner. And mm-hmm. to me, when it comes to thinking about solutions, I think that solutions are about defining the phenomenon and making them act in a desired manner. So to me, it's about having meaningful conversations coming from multiple sides in the black community, especially based around class, mm-hmm. and making it where when you have a 7-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old, they don't that they're having meaningful conversation with their cousins across the tracks. You see what I'm saying? And making it where it's not just particular, like you only see your black family during the family reunion time.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You only see your black family in the hood during holiday times. Nah, we don't do that. You see what I'm saying? So what I did was I moved closer, you feel me, to my black family, you mm-hmm. know what I'm saying, to my black families that's in the hood. Do I live in the hood? Nah. See what I'm saying? I live in the burbs.
Right.
But my literally everybody is from the hood just left my house this morning. You know what
right,
I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, shit, my kids is not only gonna be interacting with a family that's, you feel me, not in the burbs during tragedies mm-hmm. and during holidays. We gonna cut that off right then. We also make it where, you feel me, I want you to understand blackness and black people for yourself and not just through the lens of your classmates. But also too, I was very mindful
society.
my neighborhood is some Africans, it's some African Americans, you feel me? We got some Mexican mix straight from Mexico, you know what I'm saying? So for me, it was like I wanted my kids to really see people of color and more importantly black people in as many different positions as possible and as normalized as possible on an everyday. That's to me, that's the solution. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not thinking about it in when we can only do it these moments, but it's how can we normalize these engagements and these interactions every single day.
Right.
You feel me? What I learned, shout out to Pastor Coleman at University of Oklahoma. When I took his African-American leadership class, something I was able to understand from the jump is how Malcolm X differed from Martin Luther King from mm-hmm. a socioeconomic standpoint and how their experiences dealing with white supremacy and white supremacists really structured their strategy and really structured the way in which they carried themselves and how they dealt with it. You see what I'm saying? And I seen at a very young age how they got pit against each other. That's the important thing.
Yeah.
How they got pit against each other. I'm going to say it again. How they got pit against each other. So the answer and the question, how I start the answer, Huey P. Newton says that power is the ability to define the phenomenon and make it act in a desired manner. What is the phenomenon in ways and how black people are pit against each other when it comes to socioeconomic differences?
Yeah.
And for me, it's thinking about what that is. You see what I mean? I know right now on social media, hey, peep game, there are a lot of middle-class black people that spent their whole life chastising niggas from the hood. But now, putting out that aesthetic is cool. Now, being a little bit more hood, a little bit more street, a little bit more raspy, a little bit more raw, that's cool.
Yeah.
So now you're putting on black hood aesthetics, like a costume, like the white folks do. You're black, though.
Yeah,
you're doing it. You see what I'm saying? So to me, it's like, let's have these conversations. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
To me, is what it's about. Because to me, I really got a beef with that.
Yeah.
I got people I went to school with. You feel me? We graduated in high school. We graduated college, goddamn, in 2014. You spent from 09 to 14 talking shit about how we should act.
Right.
The internet rolled around, social media rolled around. You want to be a content creator. And now all of a sudden, you is way more hood than you ever been being on this internet.
Yeah.
We got to have them conversations. But we also got to have the conversations as well. It's like, hey, what does it mean to define success and how you have proximity to whiteness and white people? And this is what I learned right here. It's a lot of black people from the hood like me that experience a little bit of economic mobility, and then you buy into the same ways that we define luxury and success. That's what I learned. So that's how I end this too, for real. The solution is recognizing how we define success in proximity to white people and how we define failure in proximity or how distant you are from black people.
Wow. Wow. That's
that's what I think.
Yeah. Right. I think with everything that you said, because every time you talk, I feel like there's a lot to unpack. So I feel like Malcolm X, Martin Luther King pitted against each other. How we define our success as it correlates to white folks. I feel like in our community, there's nobody that's coming like to save us. Like, I feel like in each culture, like Asian and Indian, white, whatever, I feel like there's somebody that has been appointed. That's why we like, you know, glorify Tupac and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, because those were the people that were pinned to help us, you know, progress in whatever we were going through in that moment, you know, whether we were, you know, fighting against injustices or, you know, boycotting the bus movement. I just feel like they were the people that were the designated black folks. As a community, how can we save ourselves? Like, I feel like whether it's, you know, lower class and up, middle class, I think there's just a lot of things that are happening in our community that we could fix for ourselves first before we tackle how we can perceive ourselves as it relates to white success. You know what I mean?
That's 1%. When I was younger, I came across this speech from Sister Soldier, man. Sister Soldier was talking at I think it was the Donahue show, you feel me? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dr. Cornel West was there, and a lot of people was there. You know what I'm saying? I felt like a few other black people was there. And what she was talking about is how within America, there are no institutions that teach people of African descent the knowledge of ourselves and where we come from. Mm-hmm. I think that because there is such a identity crisis amongst black people, regardless of your gender, your class, your sexuality that exists amongst us, it mm-hmm. makes it where we don't have a knowledge of self. We don't have a self-awareness, a mm-hmm. self-love, a self-care. So it makes it where within the community, a lot of us are stuck in individualism, and we lost in the sauce of, I think that egotistical capitalism, egotistical. So I ain't going to put the word egotistical in front of it, because it's egotistical, it's capitalism, right?
Right. But
my point is, it's like, that when we want to prove our self-worth, a lot of the ways that we have been indoctrinated to prove our self-worth to ourselves and to the world is just anti-black at the core. You know what I'm saying? You got to cut yourself off to fit yourself in, you know what I'm saying, this, that, and the other. And because so many of us have been able to experience upper mobility in different ways by doing exactly that, making ourselves more adaptable, making ourselves more palatable, making ourselves more marketable, making ourselves more accessible, making ourselves, hey, a lot of that shit makes it where you get to be seen as the magical Negro at the expense of somebody else not being seen as the magical Negro.
Ooh.
You see what I'm saying? I'm from the hood, right? My daddy, my mama, you feel me? Shit. So I'm knowing, hey, I've been compared. You know what? My success has been weaponized against a lot of people that I love, a lot of people that I relate to. I'm going to say that again, but just think about that very deeply. My individual success, my blood, my sweat, my tears, and what I've done to get here where I'm at has been weaponized against a lot of people that I love because they're not where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
If you can, George Lee can do it, why you can't do it?
Right.
And recognizing that type of chastising is way that first of all, is not realistic. See what I'm saying? The glass effect is real. And I recognize, like, hey, man, you being able to show an individual person that comes from a community does not make it immune to structures and the inaccessible ways that in this community exists. So it's a point out. You point out that a nigga made it from the hood does not negate the infrastructure and the trials, tribulations, and infrastructure of the hood.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna say it again. Point out that an individual made it from the south side of Oklahoma City or this side of Tulsa does not mean that that side of Oklahoma City or that side of Tulsa is not messed up with, you feel me, policing.
Man.
You see what I'm saying? It does not mean that this person is not, most people have a high likely chance of being stuck in that motherfucker.
Right.
And you should not use my success to make it where, well, he got out, so you can't get out. And even that terminology, getting out. You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Hey, listen, man. The poor lower white people, the way in which they relate to the explosive parts of their community is not how we do it in the black community.
Man.
I just was going off about this on my YouTube channel, literally. Hey, as black people, if I want to have my success and want to prove that I'm not like the other niggas, I have to buy into the exposability and disposability of the hood.
Mm.
The white people don't do the KKK like that. The KKK will always already be taken care of because the white people buy into that humanity of the KKK. You don't have to disavow the entirety existence of the KKK, but you have to disavow the entirety of gang violence and thuggery. See what I'm saying? And to me, that's a part of the problem and a part of the beef, why we have such a big beef against middle-class black people and lower-class black people. Because then you have middle-class black people that are able to deploy the same type of terminology and perspective that the white people do. Mm. And then you have the same black people that are able to look at white people in the middle, black people in the middle class and be like, but you rich. And it's like, nah, nigga, they are working middle class. So on this instance, that's how I said, poor black people, financially illiterate, and we weaponize our financial illiteracy against middle class black people. Middle class black people, racially illiterate, weaponize your racial illiteracy against the poor niggas. And that's why I feel like that's how I'm right. That's how that chapter in that book gonna start. That's my argument. And I'm sitting on it. I'm defending it. Whatever, you feel me? Niggas on the bottom class, we financially illiterate. So we'll think an individual, you feel me, making six figures a year is rich.
Yeah.
You feel me?
Yeah. Not and I rich. Wrote what I wrote down whenever you were saying that is get it out the mud versus getting it to live. Like I feel like why as black people, I'm just saying, as black people, why do we feel like we have to have this crab in the middle mindset to weaponize each other's success? Like what you said at the very beginning, you felt like you were being weaponized for having the success that you have against the other people in your community. Like everybody can get it. Whenever I see, I know I keep talking about other races, like white folks, and I don't see them saying, like you just said, for the KKK, I don't see them demeaning them in every aspect of their life, whether it be success, whether it be gang violence, whether it be whatever it is. It's like we're always being hit over the head one way or another. You can't win for losing at that point. You know what I mean? Like if you're successful, you have to be bad because you made it through. If you are not successful, yeah, you have to be made to feel bad because you got it out the mud. I just feel like that's what is happening in our culture, at least.
Well, I think that what I know about whiteness and white supremacy is that white people have the privilege of individualism. Mm-hmm. And if we're being real, white folks care more about whiteness than they care about other white people.
Ooh, you know that's a good point.
And because that is to me, a truism, it makes it where, let's be real, I don't want to further pathologize black people. So I can acknowledge the unique ways that classism exists amongst white people. Mm-hmm. I can acknowledge there is a class conflict amongst white people. Mm-hmm. I can acknowledge that middle class white people, lower class white people, upper class white people, they beef with each other with their class identities, right? Mm-hmm. I also can acknowledge that the way that policy is curated will always already try to take care of the white middle class and poor white middle people. Let me see, poor white people, right?
Yeah.
So when I acknowledge that, I'm able to recognize still, though, how white people tend to not chastise each other the way in which that we chastise each other
for
taking the government assistance. You see what I'm saying? Government assistance, these safety net was created for poor white people.
Yeah.
Created by rich white people. Rich black folks act like this thing doesn't exist and we will be like, well, you're on welfare and you're on HUD, you're on food stamps and blah, 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 blah. Hey, listen, I got people that still on food stamps and HUD.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, see that's what I'm real. Saying? That's real.
And because I got them, I know that, I see them, I still talk to them, we still kick it and make it where I feel like, going back to what you asked, what's the solution? It's like, well, I think the solution is recognizing the problem and recognizing the solution is a process and not an action, but also recognizing how much you implicated within the problem. I recognize I was implicated in the problem when I was getting all these damn degrees, getting all these damn followers, getting all these opportunities, and I was one of three black people that lived in my neighborhood.
Mm.
I realized I was a part of the problem. You see what I'm saying? Man. I realized I'm a part of the problem, nigga, building an international, you feel me, a platform talking about white supremacy and this, that, and the other. But I live in a white community. I go to a predominantly white university and educate predominantly white kids. And the only time niggas get to see me is when I'm on the internet. I'm a part of the problem. You see what I'm saying? So, shit, what I had to do to be a part of the solution was acknowledge I'm a part of the problem and then try to do something individually where I'm at. But also acknowledging that it's still a process, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, me living around other black people is not enough. Me being close to my family is not enough. Now I need to be more intentional with teaching my kids right now while they 5 and 7 about black empowerment, about the different textures of black people, about, you feel me, being light-skinned, about, like, you know what I'm saying? I've already sprinkled a little bit in there, you know what I'm saying? But now I'd be more intentional with how I'm fathering and how I'm conscious Lee.
Yeah.
George Lee.
Yeah.
So my fathering and my parenting should look a little different than everybody else's. So now it's about really, really, really sticking with that, really sitting on that. You see what I'm saying? And shit, I think sometimes it's easier said than done.
Yeah, and I think it just goes back to our point when we were saying, like, healing is a journey. And I think that as a black community, we're in a constant state of healing because we are constantly being triggered by things that have been happening over the 400 years. And so once that happens again, we are like starting at the beginning of our healing journey because it's like, okay, so what do we need to do? What protests? What people are speaking out? What people aren't speaking out? You know, so it's like, it's just a constant thing. I don't know how close we are to hitting a point where we feel like we as people can make the change or, you know, begin the healing journey from where we are instead of keep starting over. You know what I mean? Just yeah. using that as an analogy.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure, for sure.
But also I wanted to mention this before I move on to our next topic. Do you feel like segregation was the best time for black people because we, like you said, you were one of, I don't know how many people living in a white neighborhood and going to a white institution, but, you know, back then we had black doctors, you know, construction, dentist, whatever it was, you name it, we had it, hairstylist, all of it.
I would say that there was definitely a time in segregation where there's probably a lot more black unity and black camaraderie mm-hmm. because we were forced to be around each other and we were, you know what I'm saying, like our only option was to be around each other in many different options, in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I've become very careful of the way we romanticize the 1960s, 1950s, 1940s
mm-hmm.
because a lot of times we want to think about how like that white supremacist violence,
mm-hmm.
how that anti-black violence operated. And it's like, hey, when we had black doctors and we had black bankers and black banks and mm-hmm. black schools and mm-hmm. black principals, what did that mean for me? I have to ask myself that, you feel me? When I moved to Oklahoma and I was able to be really empowered and inspired by Black Wall Street, by, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? North Tulsa.
Yeah.
But then you think about it on a level of violence, it's like, hey, having that many black doctors and black banks didn't make us immune to white supremacist violence.
Yeah. I think that, like you said, I don't want to romanticize that because I think that the violence that happened, the things that we went through were terrible. Like, I couldn't even imagine, you know, the level of, you know, forethought that they had to have, the level of yeah. patience that they had to have, the level of, you know, just being who they were in that moment, just to get back on their feet after that, because I still feel like after all of those things happened and our cities being put under lakes, but I digress from that whole subject, you know, because that's a whole nother topic.
It's a part of the shit, though. It's a part, yeah. A part of it is that, though. I think it's really thinking about how when we are able to practice kinship in a way that is able to give like result into political, social, economic infrastructure. How even when we live in a segregated times that still brought about racial fear and paranoia that made white people feel justified into putting your lake, putting your town under a lake, or mm-hmm. setting your shit on fire. So yeah, for me, yeah, I always think about like, okay.
Or under a highway.
Tulsa. Or, you know what I'm saying? Or throw a highway to it. You know what I'm saying? So to me, it's really thinking about like, I can say that there's probably a bigger level of racial pride back in those segregation times.
I think.
But to me, it's so much more complex. That's how I think about it. That's how I would say it. Like simplified. You know what I'm saying? No soliloquy.
Yeah.
To me, it's just so much more complex.
It's definitely so much more complex than I'm about to make it seem. But I feel like for our Black community, because that's what I like to focus on.
Facts.
I think us being together like that was the best for us. Now, like you just said, the complexity, all the layers that come with it, I'm not saying that that was the best for us or the best for our world, but us being together, I feel like that's a solution in itself. Because we, like you said, we're forced to grow in our Blackness because we were all together. But because of all the layers that happened in between, like, you know, the violence, the things that happened in that time, we weren't able to fully progress as a people. Lakes, you know, highways,
now, I think you might have seen, fires. I think you may have just inspired a video. But I think that when we talk about defining the phenomenon and making it acting in a desired manner and thinking about the way in which Black people beef with each other, there has to be a lot of unpackaging that we do about how a lot of the city demolishing, community demolishing plays into how we beef with each other right now, especially on the economic ways. Because let's be real, right? When I learned about the Osage murders and how they overlap with the time of the Tulsa race massacre, and that thought about how, you know, not only like indigenous and people and Black people related, I thought about more specifically what we're talking about is how like there was a Black middle class and a Black lower, you know what I'm saying, Black lower middle class and a Black, you know what I'm saying, people that was in poverty, you feel me, in you know what I'm saying, in that time. We'd be fools not to think so.
Yeah.
Think about how those different positions went into how they understood how the city went under, or how they weren't able to protect the city, or how the funds of the city was insured, or how, you know what I'm saying? I didn't thought about and heard about so many different ways that I think we might have a nice little TikTok video right after this. Like, what? I think that, because in my mind, it's almost like, how come y'all never talk about the amount of communities and cities that has been put under lakes, burnt down, had a highway put through them. When y'all talk about why Black people can't move forward, when y'all talk
or
about
have
why
industries
the Black
put on them, so, like paper industries, oil industries, I don't know,
why the Black community is so far behind, this, that, and the other. It's like, man, we could think of three major ways off top of the head that have had tax dollars and or different parts of government be involved in either flooding this city and putting Lake Lanier here or some shit, putting I-35 here, or goddamn, you know what I'm saying? It's just like really thinking about that, but also recognizing like what that does for us.
Or putting...
And how we internalize Black inferiority, right? Just think about it. If you don't know this shit and you're 21, you might be like, man, Black people always decrepit, always bad. We ain't never got shit because we ain't never been shit.
Yeah.
That's it.
Or think about it like this. I'm going to say this first before I say that. If you haven't heard of any of the things that we're talking about, I encourage you to go research. So let's talk about wokeism and how it affects your content.
Well, you know, I started off my conscious journey on being woke and being sparked into staying woke. So I would say that a lot of the Black radical tradition is full of my foundation and how I do what I do. I also recognize that in our current climate, there's a lot of anti-woke shit going on. So the way that my content gets backlash, it gets pushed back towards, as well as I think influenced and structured by the current climate of wokeism. And it is infused and structured by the former past understandings of wokeism. So yeah.
That's what's up. I mean, I hate that your content gets, you know, pushed back, because You know, the reason for this episode, I feel like you bring so much value. You know, you open up people's minds to different ways to think of things. And that's what this show is about. It's a perspective, you know, gauging people's perspectives, whether you agree with them, whether you don't, or both. Like, it's so important for us in society to have people like you, people like me, people that are extremely to the opposite side or to the other side, because we are people and we can have different outlooks on life. And so that's the reason why I wanted you to be on this show in the first place.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been a fan way before we even met, at Juneteenth last year. If y'all ain't know, this is my brother right here. We've been hosting together the past 2 years. And so I've just, had a lot of, admired you from a distance. Didn't even know you were in Oklahoma. Now that you've moved back, I'm super glad that you are able to give people like myself, like brown and black men, all people, I'll say, but specifically in the black community, a voice, or something to say, yeah, I agree with that. Or, yeah, I can stitch that and also, put my perspective on top of it. But let's move on to a positive note. Your recent accomplishment of executive producing and starring in your very own documentary. I need the backstory on it. Take me through how you were able to, get that opportunity with Issa Rae's company, like you said before in the show. That's super amazing.
Yeah, I was a part of the YouTube Black Voice class of 2022. Uh-huh. Yeah, 2022. And as a result, I had the opportunity to submit a movie outline for the American Black Film Festival. And when I submitted the movie outline, Issa Rae's company thought it was dope and decided they wanted to fund the film. And it's an opportunity that I got uniquely as being a part of YouTube Black Voices Creator Fund. That's really those two things came together right there. It was a long process. I will say, I can't imagine what it would look like to do like a long movie or documentary. My documentary is only, I think, about 15 minutes long.
Okay.
And shit, we shot, like, we had, for a 15-minute long documentary, I swear we had like 15 hours of footage.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
But I feel like, I know you say you can't think about doing it, but I feel like you're going to get there soon. Sooner than later, you're going to get into those lengthy.
That opportunity to go to the American Black Film Festival opened me up to an industry and a realm that I never seriously thought about. Like, I thought about, like, it would be dope if I could do a movie or do a voiceover or do this or do that. Doing that film showed me like, oh, nah, this is easy. Y'all consider me a storyteller in the content I already make? A word? Okay, bet. And then just being able to recognize having the voice, you know what I'm saying? Being able to, I feel like because I come from I did a lot of poetry and portrait contests growing up. So I know how to fluctuate my voice.
Yeah.
Go real high, go low, go fast, go slow. So being able to, I feel like, do that on a film, and then people being able to be like, oh my God, you have a good voice, this, that, and the other. So it's like, shit, I'm definitely trying to get as many checks as possible and opportunities as possible.
I heard
when
that.
It come to,
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's, like I said, I'm going to keep giving you your flowers as much as possible. I think that's amazing. Especially in the standpoint of representation, because I feel like, the traditional path has been pushed so much to our black community. Like I said, I'm gonna focus on that this episode, our black community, but our people in general, just the traditional pathway of like, go to school, do this, do that. But I feel like even though you've taken, a traditional path, you were able to say, let me see how this will go. Making content and then that has created a lane, a bag, everything.
Hopefully we can increase the size of the bag, and I ain't gotta worry about how I drip what's in the bag around, you feel me, type shit.
Right.
I ain't gotta be so much into what's the mode they would call it? Scarcity mode,
Yeah.
But I really think that social media was able to change our reality for the good and the bad, and make it where a lot of black people uniquely are able to get access and resources to things you probably wouldn't have had access to before social media. I know when it comes to being in like film and doing like that whole, you know what I'm saying, mode, I feel like I just learned so much from the process to the many different teams to kind of how you can get funding. It's like 50 different film festivals, man. I'm talking about it. So it's really learning about the industry and just learning more about business and learning more about how to diversify your one presence as much as possible. It's really what social media is about. Once you're able to get you a little following, when you get a, I'm saying, once you get a following, what can you, how many ways can you take advantage of that following and diversify the ways you're able to bring value to that following? And that's something that you just learn as you go through the process every day and make it where shit, you might've started making videos about white supremacy and you looked up and now you doing videos about all type of different identities. Yeah. And now you feel me getting opportunities to go speak and consult and write books. And so you never know, but it could be really based off of shit. You just being getting a small following on one platform that can go to other platforms.
Yeah, that's amazing for sure. I like to ask this to all of my guests. What does passion versus purpose mean to you?
Passion versus purpose. I've never heard of that before, actually. I usually think about what your passion, I usually think about it in terms of,
it doesn't
of
have to be like versus
being together.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's, yeah,
it doesn't,
yeah,
have to be a versus thing, but what does like passion mean to you and what does purpose mean to you, or how do they combine in some way? If that,
yeah, to me, that, yeah, yeah, to me, like, I always think about it in terms of purpose versus popularity. And a lot of times what gives you purpose don't really give you, don't make you popular, or vice versa. And usually to me, passion is usually the determining factor of whether it is a purpose or whether it's something that gets you popular. Let's pop passionate about being popular, and that's a whole nother conversation. But right. I think that being able to be authentic, being able to say what you mean and mean what you say, in a very meaningful way, is usually, you know, brings purpose. And being able to think about what brings you passion, you know what I'm saying, sometimes is able to kind of not bring purpose to you, at least, if not the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. But I think about like what make me tick and learn about in our world now. We live in an attention economy.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Usually what you give attention to, shit gonna give money. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I don't spend my money everywhere, so I don't spend my attention everywhere.
Ooh.
So I think about when it comes to my passion and my attention and purpose, is like try to spend that very frugally.
Yeah. I don't know why they just made me think of, I don't know who said it. I feel like Lil Baby said it. He said, my body goes everywhere, but not my energy. You know, I mean, not my, my energy. I think that's what he said. Like, sometimes your physical presence is there, but you don't allow yourself to delve into some of that energy, you know, that comes with it, whether it be bad energy. I would think is bad energy. Hopefully you allow yourself to receive good energy. But I don't know why that just made me think of that, if that means anything. So we're wrapping up here. I had this conversation with my dad. Shout out to him about gaining perspectives.
Shout out to dad.
Yeah. About gaining perspectives from individuals who, you know, gain success in their own right. But to make a long story short, he said that his true interest was to hear people's unfair advantages. So I think for you, I want to hear what your unfair advantage it was, you know, in your coming up story, where you are now, whatever part of your journey that was, that could possibly help, you know, somebody that's listening in their journey, whether they're in school, whether they are maybe still in the hood, they're trying to get out. But what was that piece, that like one part of your journey that was like, you know what, that's an unfair advantage that I had that may have help me to level up in my career?
Yeah. Shit, I got a lot of them I think of all the time, because, you know, the way my consciousness works, I always think about different journeys and different trajectories of life and how what you experienced or what you had to start with impacted that trajectory, especially compared to other ones. I'm a homeboy that is one of two or three homeboys out of like 20 mm-hmm. that got a relationship with their father and they know their father mm-hmm. and that was raised by their father. I always think about not necessarily an unfair advantage, but an mm-hmm. advantage that I had compared to my other homeboys that I was able to be poured into and to be scoped, you know what I'm saying, by not only another black man, but a black man that was my father. And my father, that though he was, you know what I'm saying, incarcerated a lot and in and out of jail and shit, he was able to teach me how to promote and how to advertise. My unfair advantage being a social media content creator is that before the internet was a thing, I already understood the science behind promotion and advertising.
Okay.
Because I was raised by hustling as, promoting, advertising as.
Yeah.
You feel me? Finessing as, drug dealing as,
yeah.
concert throwing. Like, my father was an entrepreneur. I was raised by an entrepreneur. My advantage that I have in social media is that I'm an entrepreneur. You know what I'm saying? I know from a personality standpoint, when I started learning more about blackness, black people, access, palatability, how certain black people and certain presentations of blackness and black people is more digestible for white folks than others. Mm-hmm. So I understood. I feel like when I was like 17, that I was much more charming and charismatic than other black boys. Mm. And therefore, I was more palatable and more acceptable and more stomachable than, you know what I'm saying, especially in my most rawest moments. When I'm mad, pissed off, a lot of white people viewed it as being charming or was like very infatuated with how I was and who I was.
Mm.
And that was my advantage. When I learned that I had ADHD, it was a double-edged sword. I think that me having ADHD, me being neurodivergent, me having my impulses give me an unfair advantage and being a content creator because I'm a content machine.
Mm.
I don't think about it. I just do it. I just do it. I just do it. I just do it. And mm-hmm. I look up and I produce a lot of shit. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I don't think about it. But I also recognize that my unfair advantage is that I think that my charm, my charisma, and me being friendly allow for my ADHD to be seen as much more of a gifted and talented type skill
mm-hmm.
than my homeboys. They got criminalized, pathologized, policed, you feel me?
Mm.
Confirmation bias, you know what I'm saying, thrown on them. So I could think of various ways that I had an advantage. Also, I was raised, while living with my mama, I was the only boy, you feel me? I was the only boy. Mama had four kids, you feel me? Me being the oldest and the only boy made it where I benefited from patriarchy and sexism in my household from my black mama in different ways than my sisters did. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so I was able to jump off the porch and go outside and be outside till 10 o'clock at nighttime.
Yeah.
My sisters can go outside unless their room was clean and when the street light came on, we all have to be in the house. But at a certain point, Little George didn't have to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I got to do what I want to do, how I want to do. That was an unfair advantage that I had because I was able to experience a little bit more life than Sherrielle, Shanna, and only my three sisters. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it made it where it was that. Also, my unfair advantage was I was able to move out of my mom's house where she was really strung out on drugs and really having all the local drug dealers come to the house and cook crack in the, you know what I'm saying, microwave and shit. I was able to leave.
Wow.
I moved out and moved to my grandma's house. My unfair advantage with my sisters is that I was able to experience more access, resources, and opportunities from just moving myself out of that home and going to a different home. So I feel like it's a lot of different ways I thought about what I've been able to experience and what somebody else did not experience and how I had the privilege of experiencing it. But I've also thought about the ways in that I've not had to experience certain shit that other folks had to experience, and that was my unfair advantage.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
That's
my mom
really
and my
good.
Daddy
yeah.
on drugs, but I know my mom and my daddy.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I know my mom and my daddy. I know who they look like. I know, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I got family members and, you know what I'm saying, people that I've been around and been with, they don't know who their daddy is. Or they had never been around their mama. Their mama was on drugs for first 9 years of their life. They didn't meet their mama until that was 10 years old.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? I got a partner that ain't met his mama until he was, you know what I'm saying, 12. You know what I'm saying? I got another partner, he ain't meet his daddy until his mama got killed.
Ooh.
You know what I'm saying?
Jesus.
Like, so like when I think about, like, it's always somebody that got it worse than you. It's always somebody that got it better than you. And I think that I've been able to be blessed with a mind that I can be very well-rounded and think about my advantages and my disadvantages, but still think about how they cultivate together to make it where I move, how I move. I think I'm being long-winded, but the last thing I say about in response to this, when I was debater at the University of Oklahoma,
uh-huh.
I learned how to take my structural disadvantages and make them intellectual argumentative advantages.
You better
speak.
It's
a portable skill that still speaks with me, though. It's a portable skill that still sticks with me, though.
Yeah.
Like all my trials, tribulations, disadvantages, you know what I'm saying, shortcomings, I've been able to flip them and think about how it gave me resilience, how it gave me strength, how it gave me consciousness, how it gave me understanding, and being able to present them in a way where it's not like, oh, woe is me. I've always had it bad. My mama was on drugs and my daddy sold drugs. And when I was in college, my mama and my daddy was in jail and I was feel sorry for me. Like,
right.
Like, everything I just said was true. But yeah. I don't want you to feel sorry for me.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? If anything, I want to make it where if somebody else is experiencing what I'm experiencing in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and know that like your story is just that. It's your story. It doesn't have to be your reality. Or how I say it when I'm booked to go talk to young kids in the hood or in different situations, it's like I'm an avid believer that we're all products of our environment.
Yeah.
But I'm a more avid believer that you get to dictate the type of product that your environment creates. And I usually simplify and go to a metaphor and be like, hey, peep game, man. You take your crazy ass into a Nike, to a Nike warehouse. That's that is the environment, the Nike warehouse.
Yeah.
Hey, but Nike made hoodies, t-shirts, headbands, socks, running shoes, basketball shoes, wrestling shoes. You get to choose some product you want to be. You feel me? Like, I'm a product of convicted felons. I'm a product of low employment, high police presence. You see what I'm saying? But I'm a smart nigga. You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm a person that took everything I went through, created some survival tactics and survival skills, but now I'm no longer worried about surviving. I now want to heal, want to thrive. But it's like, shit, now it's me telling my story. I don't tell my story to make people feel sorry for me. I tell my story so you know where I come from and you get why I tick. But more importantly, I tell my story because I know it's other people experiencing what I experience.
Yeah, you know, and it's a culmination of all your experiences. It's who you are. I heard this story, I think it was yesterday or the day before. He said that, you know, he came from the hood. You know, he went to prison. This guy, I think it was Wall Street Trapper, actually. Shout out to him as well.
Yeah, Wall Street Trapper. He said he went to
He went to prison and all of that. But he said a friend told him that you are, you know, in this position where you have all this knowledge now about, you know, stocks and building business and things like that. But don't let go of the person who you were before, because that person has value. But don't let that the value that they bring overtake you to take you back to that place, but to help propel you in the spaces that you're in right now. So I think about that for you. You know, you're just a culmination of your experiences, but you don't have, the product doesn't necessarily have to look the same as where you come from. And I also
and the
like
product
to,
is never finished
ever. And I also like to look at it from the perspective of favor ain't fair. It is not at all. Nah. So with all that being said, what you got coming up next?
Man, I've really been dragging my feet on finishing this book. I have a book coming out about social media and social issues about the race, class, gender, ability, sexuality, ethnicity, language. Each chapter about a different identity topic and what my journey, experience, perspective has been on being a educator on the internet, talking about that particular social issue on social media. And I think it's going to be a very, very, very good book. I think it's going to change the way that my life is situated right now. I'm being real. And then I have a
New York Times bestseller coming.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Hey, being real, I already got literary agents and the book people that's really, you know what I'm saying, trying to start the bidding process for this book. Yeah. So, you know what I'm saying, I'm happy about that. I have a online class that I'm also going to be uploading as well. I'm putting the finishing touches on the curriculum and getting it recorded. And then just more content. I've been playing about the streaming. So this month I plan on really getting into my weekly streaming. I want to call it a podcast. I want to call it a stream. So I feel like when I start calling the podcast, I get overwhelmed. But I've done the podcast thing and I just got respect for everybody that do podcasts because it is not... It's not encouraging. Yeah. Ain't for the feel. Hey, man, you can put together some amazing speaking points.
Yeah,
I'm talking about have a conclusion, an opening, a body, and I'm talking about you didn't spend a week putting together this shit. You hop on the screen and you be talking to two people: you, your mama, and your friend. You, two strangers you never seen before, and it's three of y'all for an hour, and it's like, so, man, yeah. When y'all see people, yeah. That's how I want to end this, actually. If you watching this, mm-hmm. and you are a friend, a family of Dashari, and you want to see her make it to what she's making it to,
come on.
Though usually I say, you know what I mean, your biggest supporter going to be a stranger, and somebody you know and love going to be your biggest hater. Yeah. Though that is still true, if you want to be the exception to that rule, or you really want to see Dashari make it to spaces and places where her voice and her perspective is being heard, make sure you engage her content specifically on podcasts. Like on podcasts specifically, because yeah. it's a lot of yeah. spinning of the wheels mm-hmm. and shit, you might not go nowhere. You see what I'm saying? So yeah. again, if you want to see Dashari do her damn thing in different
talk
stages,
to him kind of sleep.
Different people, different opportunities.
Yeah.
Support what she doing on these podcasts.
Yeah.
Ain't got to be this episode either. I know she do a lot of episodes. She grind hard. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So shit, find episodes you like, but share it. Comment on it. Subscribe to it. Shit. You feel what I'm saying?
When
you hop on Twitter, or you know what? When you getting on Threads and you be everybody hopping on these new apps, go on and find your favorite. It's a perspective episode, and share the link on Spiel app.
Come
share
on.
Share the link on Twitter.
Come
share
on.
Share the link on Facebook.
Yeah.
Share the link on Threads. What I know is that being a Black creative, a lot of the disadvantages that we have a lot of times is the people around us don't want to support our shit until we don't need their support no more. You see what I'm saying? Or you don't want to support the shit until you see other people see value in it.
Come
don't
on, do consciously.
That. Please don't do that. Like, if you've been around Dashari before everybody else knew who she was, keep that same energy. And I say this to
please.
End it. If you're not fucking with her right now,
man,
and you're not trying to put no soil you into the ground, when you start seeing them fruit start being buried, keep your ass from the garden. And don't tell her she acting brand new. Don't tell her she acting.
Listen,
different.
Rip me out the plastic. I've been acting brand new.
Swear to, hey,
rip me
hey,
out the plastic.
Swear to God. You see what I'm saying? We don't want to hear it, though. She's going to be acting brand new, and you better not act different because you've been acting
on.
Brand new.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And same goes for consciously. Listen, I know he has a platform, but it ain't never too much sharing. It's never too much commenting. It's never too much sharing it to these new platforms that are dropping because, you know, Elon Musk is doing too much on that Twitter. So it's never too much of that. You know, go support my brother as well.
Ooh, I lied too. You seen Elon Musk, it's the last thing for real though.
Okay. Shut up,
right? We do a lot of hooping and hollering about supporting Black businesses and supporting Black institutions.
Hey.
I got a beef with Black people that hold Black institutions to different standards than you hold the white ones.
Wow.
There was a lot of beef that happened over the past few days with Spiel app, the Black alternative to Twitter. The fact that there are Black people trying to hold this Spiel app to different standards you ain't never held the previous owners of Twitter or Elon Musk to is baffling.
Man.
That's
hey,
it.
That's it. That's all. That's all that needed to be said. Right. So, before we get off of here, if you could leave my audience with one thing, what would you say?
If I could leave your audience with one thing, I really would say the two things I already said, but I really want to make sure you heard them when I said them, and you really, how Country Wayne say, you let it marinate in your spirit.
Yeah, sizzle.
If you want to be a creative or you want to actualize a vision,
yeah.
I don't give a damn whether you want to be the best doctor, the best lawyer, the best content creator, rapper, dancer. It's just a truism how capitalism and egos work. Your biggest supporter, you have not met them yet.
Mm.
Your supporters, you probably don't know them all yet. Your haters, you know them.
Yeah.
Don't take it personal that your classmates, your cousins, your family members is not supporting you the way they think you support you. Don't cry and be like, man, the reason why I can't make it nowhere is because nobody wants to support me.
Right.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Consciously went through that, consciously continues to go through that. Your biggest supporter gonna be a stranger, somebody you know gonna be your biggest hater.
Man.
And the last thing I'll say is, you feel me? Purpose over popularity. It's so real because a lot of people do things for clicks. We live in the attention economy and people jump through the roof to get a little click in attention and popularity. But if that's not your purpose or your passion, we're going to be able to tell. If you're faking in front to be a goddamn orange and you're really an apple, when we squeeze you, we're going to see your apple juice.
Man.
We're not going to see none of the pulp from the orange. So
wow.
Stop faking it.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? And then something that really impacted me in 2019 when I started taking off on TikTok. As a matter of fact, it's a lot. I feel like Nipsey Hussle died a few months before I got on TikTok. Mm-hmm. A Nipsey Hussle interview really impacted who Conscious Lee is on the internet and how I move and how I keep that same hunger. Mm-hmm. He was on the I think the leakers report, I think, you know what I'm saying? Okay. Talking to Big Boy. Mm-hmm. And Big Boy asked him, like, man, so Nipsey, man, what's the advice you give? Was, I don't know. I can't remember what he asked him. Nipsey Hussle said some shit like, I ain't gonna act like I've always been this poised and this confident. The only difference between me and everybody else is I ain't give up. I've been through all the emotions in this shit. I've been through empowerment, depression, affirmation, negation, wanting to give up, feeling like I'm on top of the world. The only difference between Nipsey Hussle and the other rappers that's on your, you know what I'm saying, the local jokers that you deal with, is that Nipsey Hussle didn't give up. So for me, how I think about it is, shit, the only difference between me being a content curator and the people that you grew up around or you being a content curator is I've been through all the emotions of being a content curator. Mm-hmm. The insecurities, the affirmation, the validation, the questioning who I am, what I stand for, to knowing who I am and what I stand for. You feel me? To feeling like I'm being slighted, to feeling like I'm not getting what I need, to feeling like nobody care about me and support me and think about nobody give a damn what I got to say, to people really holding on to every word I have. Even right now, I got over 3 million followers, and I would be lying to you if I didn't say, if I said that there is moments that I feel like I have 3 followers, or there's moments that I have over 3 million followers and I feel like I'm not getting enough opportunities, or how I pay my bills or how I feed my kids, the followers is not doing it for me. So I'm negotiating if I should get a job again.
Wow.
So I'm still going through the motions. The only difference is, shit, I'm still in to win it, and I believe in what I build more than what somebody else gonna build for me any day of the week, regardless of how my insecurities is fucking with me at the time. You know what I'm saying? So just want that it's be real. You know what I mean? When y'all see me coming down your timeline, I'm a human being that deal with life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
no matter how confident I said it, no matter how I said it and I was 10 toes down, I go through shit as a content creator.
Yeah.
And it bothers me a lot of times that some of my friends and family members don't support me the way I think they should.
Wow.
But I've learned not to take that shit personal.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Don't take none of it.
And I just want to get real and vulnerable with y'all real fast, because it might be somebody listening to this that, you know what I'm saying, that might not listen to me usually. So it's like, shit, let me tell you something you might not have heard before.
I pray that y'all go back and y'all listen to that piece 2-3 times, because genuinely, you don't get, you know, vulnerability often from, you know, people that you probably see or who have big followings. And I pray that you take the nuggets that he dropped. Everybody goes through something. So if you feel like you are going through it, keep going. The only reason why the people that you want to be are where they want to be is because they didn't give up. The more you give up, the more you aren't going to be where you want to be. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Change your mind to change your life is my motto, okay? Where can the people find you, Conscious Lee?
I like that. TheConsciousLee.com. If you're interested in booking me to come talk to your youngsters, your employees, your students, your organization, TheConsciousLee.com. If you're interested in supporting my hustle and getting some merch, you said I got the Research of Me search sweater on.
Yeah.
I got some merch as well on the website, theconsciouslee.com. And then really, if there is an app that exists and you want some content, you want to think differently, or you want to think deeper about race, class, gender, ability, sexuality, follow me at The Conscious Lee. My motto is education is elevation. Research over me search, and saying it very raw. You know, I consider myself a professional shit talker.
Yeah.
Say no to all the sucker shit. Say no to, you know what I'm saying, stay sucker free in the land of lollipops, unless sucking is a thing you into. And then, you know, I ain't trying to kink shame and or create no homophobic in your windows, you know what I'm saying? But when I say stay from the sucker shit, from an African-American vernacular standpoint, you know exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all.
Yes. Conscious Lee, I enjoyed this conversation, my brother, more than you know. Please stay connected with Conscious Lee. He has so much coming out, y'all. He's getting into the acting world, executive producing. He's about to have a book that's dropping, a class that's coming. Well, I don't know if it's called a class, but
yeah, it's a class. A class is coming, man. Yeah, Conscious class. University, my online, you know what I'm saying, university. I already got one class in there already. You feel me? I already got one class about identity politics on my website, theconsciousleague.com. You can check it out. I have a second class coming to the Conscious University. You see Conscious League, Conscious University. Yeah, you see the, see the marketing right there?
Yeah.
But yeah, my goal is
we about to make it a universe in a minute.
Like 10, 20, yeah, universe. You know what I'm saying? I want to make it where if you don't have the grades to or the time or the scores to get into a university, I have a very accessible curriculums or the S that you can get into that can teach you portable skills.
Yeah.
To better yourself.
That's what's your pocketbook. Well, consciously keep your perspective because it definitely looks good on you. Y'all, I love y'all so much for supporting me. Please go support consciously as well. This has been a phenomenal episode. Like I said before, change your mind to change your life. You can do whatever you put your mind to. I love y'all.